it requires us to be curious. That I can look at someone's diagnoses, deficits, problems, issues, and I do look at that. But alongside that, I'm very curious about how they're living that. You know, what is it that gets you through the day? What is it that supports you to live as wholly and as fully as you can in whatever circumstance you're finding yourself? So for me, if I come with that approach, that I do recognize the pain or the difficulties and the challenges, but alongside with that, who is this person living it, and what strengths do they have? It's very humanizing. It's wonderfully humanizing, in that I'm learning more about who you are, what makes you tick, and that goes both ways. Then it's a very rich, kind of authentic relationship you're building then.
But I think the other very interesting time is when the disease itself is actually stable. And when young people call me up and say that they want to meet with me because they are facing a disclosure of the diagnosis with a boyfriend or a girlfriend, how do I tell them? What do I say? How can I be positive? How can I talk about MS? I'm really afraid of losing this relationship. So I'll have them come in and just talk about what would they like to say? What would be the timing that might be good? How might they talk about the diagnosis in a way that sort of opens up the lines of communication but doesn't make the partner sort of fearful of what's to come? So it's not to say that there aren't uncertainties associated with this illness, that there's not a potential for disability over time, but it's hopefully to engage the couple in a discussion about how they're going to approach it if there are some changes, and then to perhaps give them some skills and tools to continue that dialogue after they've left the office with me. Right. I think families often go into a situation such as MS feeling completely overwhelmed. They don't understand the illness. They don't understand the evolution. There's a tremendous amount of uncertainty. And so people are looking for ways of regaining control, because it's unpredictable when they might have a relapse or worsening. We don't really have a good sense of what provokes that. There's not a lot that they can be doing to influence the disease course, other than taking medications. The actual sort of evolution of MS is quite unpredictable. So I think it's helping them to identify the things that they can control, helping them look at how they communicate together, how they do things as a family, how they can reduce their stress, how they can keep themselves healthy in terms of lifestyle, diet and exercise. So looking for opportunities to build on perhaps what they're already doing. Just, I think, really helps people regain a sense of control. So from even in one meeting together, I see that. So the family may come in, they may feel very sort of disorganized, uncertain, out of control. And I think by building and talking about the things that they can do, what are they doing now? What is helpful, what is helping them, what do they need some help with, but kind of at the end maybe even summarizing all of the things that they are doing, the things that they're planning to do. When you sort of see that as a whole picture, I think it's a tremendous sort of opportunity to kind of reflect back on a huge number of strengths when they came in feeling quite helpless and hopeless, in fact.
I can give you an example of one of my own personal experiences from a very long time ago when I was a staff nurse. And looking back, I think this was a strengths-based approach, although I certainly didn't label it as such at the time. We had on the unit a very young woman. She was Haitian and came to Canada only a few years prior to being diagnosed with a very aggressive form of breast cancer. And right from the beginning, it was clear that this was going to be a terminal condition for her. And one of her main desires was to return back to her country, and this was clearly not going to be possible for a variety of different reasons, financially, but more importantly, physically. She couldn't even walk. And I spent hours with her on evening shift, sitting by her bedside, and she would describe to me what her life had been like in Haiti, and how she was longing for what she called these mango parties, where her family and friends would get together and they would pick mangoes off of the tree and toss them around and then peel them on the beach, I guess, and eat them and get all messy and sticky. And for her, this was a wonderful memory that she was hoping to one day relive. And even though she, on some level, understood that this wasn't going to happen, and I certainly understood that this wasn't going to happen, I let her share these stories with me again for hours. And I remember one day a friend of hers brought in some mangoes, and we sat by her bed, and she peeled them, and she ate them, and she was thrilled and gloriously happy. And this, to me, is what a strengths-based approach to nursing is. I think that that interaction that I had with her, again, looking back, I don't think I realized it at the time, but looking back, this enabled her to find some joy, to help process some other difficult emotions in the midst of all of this. You know, some would argue that this was, you know, playing up with her denial, but I think that it was actually a very effective coping strategy for her as a young woman who was dying to be able to find some pleasure in reliving very positive and happy and safe memories.
You know, one of the things as a nursing leader is that your teams will come to you with clinical issues, situations with patients and families that they're really having a difficult time understanding or managing. And what I find helpful about this approach is that it encourages us to really explore the family's uniqueness, to learn their story and to understand their history and what is important to them. And that once, as a nursing leader, you lead your team in that exercise of looking at a family through a different lens. You know, stop seeing them as problematic and really try to understand.
Okay, welcome. This has been quite a remarkable day, and we're in for a real treat with our last keynote speaker. As we always say, I'm not going to say we save the best for the last, we save the best for the second, we save the best for the third, we've also saved the best for the last. I'm really thrilled to be able to introduce, I was asked to introduce Judith Shamian, who I've known for a long time, not as long as I've known my twin sister or my other closest friend, who's I've known since grade six, who's here. But I've known her pretty long, and I could talk to you about her CV, and which is very, very impressive, or I could talk to you about Judith the person, who's quite remarkable. So I'll start talking to you a bit about Judith the person, who I find is an incredible woman, and she also has quite an impressive CV. Now, Judith is, if you ask Judith about herself, she has two passions, and she's truly passionate about nursing. She's been passionate about nursing even before she came into nursing. And she's also passionate about her family. Her family is never far from her mind. If you see Judith, she always has a phone in her hand, and it's usually one of her three daughters. She has three daughters who are calling from somewhere in the world. And no matter what's happening, if there's a president of the world calling her, Judith will take the call from her daughter. And Judith is passionate about her 16 grandchildren. She's outdone us all. If none of us could boast about our children, and we don't even engage in a conversation with Judith about our children, because then we'll have to listen to all her stories by 16 and we can't compete. The other thing is, what's remarkable about Judith, my husband and I, Bruce and I, were privileged to be at the ICN, the International Council of Nursing meeting in Melbourne, Australia, where Judith was running for president. And it was quite an interesting fight. I thought we were in the middle of a political, not an Obama-Romney type of thing, but you know, there was a lot of politicking that was going on. And Judith has this uncanny ability to connect with all leaders of all, from every country, and they came up to her as if they had found their long-lost friend. And we're talking about people from Europe and the States and from Africa and from Asia and from Latin America. And she just had this incredible ability to connect with great humility, great interest, and they all thought she was her best friend. And guess what? They turned out to be her best friend because she had a landslide election. And it's the first time I think we've had a Canadian president of International Council of Nurses, ICN, in how many years, Judith? In 40 years. So we really are truly privileged to have you, Judith, here with us. So let me tell you a little bit about Judith, the professional, her CV. Judith, as I just finished telling you, is the current president, just newly elected, of the International Council of Nurses. So what she brings to this table and to this podium in a few moments is a truly a global view of what's going on in nursing worldwide and in terms of healthcare. She knows more about what's happening and has a better sense and what is the expression, finger on the pulse, than any of us can possibly understand. She has traveled widely. She has more air miles than anyone else I know. I'm always surprised how she's able to bring 16 kids and 3 grandchildren to Florida for a holiday, and I'm sure it's all on air miles. Anyway, so she is President Emeritus and immediate past President and CEO of the Victorian Order of Nurses. She was not their nurse leader. She was the CEO of the Victorian Order of Nurses. She's the immediate past president of also the Canadian Nursing Association. She's a professor at the Lawrence Bloomberg Faculty of Nursing at the University of Toronto. She's been a co-investigator of the Nurse Health Services Research Unit. I'm getting exhausted. And was previously executive director of the Office of Nursing Policy in Health Canada, in which she made the workplace environment one of the major issues and the health of nurses one of the major issues of her tenure in that position. She was president of Mount Sinai Hospital for 10 years in Toronto. And she does have a connection with Montreal because she was at the Jewish General Hospital as one of their nursing leaders back way when. Now, she obtained her PhD from Case Western Reserve University, a master's in public health from NYU, New York University, and her baccalaureate in community nursing from the Concordia University. She is a recipient, as you can imagine, of numerous awards, including the Golden Jubilee Medal, the Governor General of Canada, the Award of Merit from CNA, this Canadian Federation. Do I have to really name all these awards? Wow, she is phenomenal. But her most recent and most prestigious award is that she has been elected as an international fellow with the American Academy of Nursing in 2009, and she has received Canada's Most Powerful Woman Top 100 Award of the Women's Executive Network. Judith, could you nominate me for one of your awards, or at least share them? Anyways, I bring you to Shamian. We're in for a treat.
Hi, guys. Don't believe anything she says. Okay, I don't know how to get this going. So can I get some help, please? I guess I should do this. Oh, it's over there or it's from my screen? Okay. We will figure it out as we go. Thank you. I really feel we should have probably finished the day with coffee. I am so full with excitement of what happened here throughout the day, it's hard to even describe it. Why is it moving? I didn't touch it, I promise. Okay, look, it's literally, we finished. I give up, you guys figure it out. I guess we all want to get out of it, and the slide's telling me get it over with. When Lori sent me the book, it goes back probably 2 years ago or so or more, and I read the book, and initially I thought, okay, it's a clinical book. I was a CEO of VON at the time. Let me just look at it, but, you know, I adore Lori. Lori always was very good for my feeding my nursing soul and mind. Okay, so this is gone? Okay. And I started to read it, and I couldn't put it down. And my comment to her was, it's probably the most powerful thing I have read since the Notes on Nursing from Florence Nightingale. And the reason I felt that is that I think as many of us, leaders in nursing and otherwise, are just not happy at the space we are. And I found that the whole approach, and I learned not to say a model, but approach, is really transformational, and it hit me in the right place in the sense of I've been getting really tired of nurses constantly complaining, constantly being unhappy, and I think it crystallized to me that it had to do with the fact that we are all schooled in the deficit model. So the only thing we knew how to do well is to bitch all the time. And here was a solution that helped us to energize. And I think there was a question in the morning how you will sell it to non-nurses. And I basically would have a very simple answer, because remember, I didn't read it as a clinician. I read it as an executive. The strength-based approach energizes you. The deficit-based approach sucks the life out of you. So which one would you choose? You know, whether you're a patient or a leader or otherwise. So when Lori said we need you to come, I really had to be today in Brazil. I came back yesterday morning from an international meeting with dozens of ministers and so on. Kind of said, I promised to Miguel, promised to Lori, I'm going to be here, and here I am. So let's talk about how we take this concept and influence it. I love the panel that talked about education, leadership, and practice, and research, because I think that's where we need to come at it. But before I start, I'm bringing you greetings from the ICN board, and this is your board. I have 16 grandchildren, but I also have 16 board members. And the board members are from all over the world, whether it's from Mauritius, Taiwan, Thailand, Ireland, Austria, Bolivia, Mexico. The list goes on. They really represent 16 million nurses. ICN has 135 organizations from 135 countries. But remember that number, there are 16 million from us, of us. And one of the speakers talked about the fact that we don't even come close to exercise the impact that we really have day in and day out. And I will take out a page from David's comment, and I will give you the end in the beginning. And basically we'll say that we keep the healthcare system alive and we make a difference every day for millions and millions and millions and millions of people in this world. Somehow it's not being recognized, it's not being acknowledged, and we are silent at the policy level. So my elevator speech usually goes like this. We have not had an educated nursing workforce as we have now, ever. You know, yes, we all celebrate Florence's brilliance and investment of statistics and so on and so forth. But collectively, we are an incredibly well-educated, well-informed, brilliant nursing group. We are really at the top. We have never had as little influence as we have now. So there is this gap. And the challenge for us is how you take this and bring it up and how you use the strength-based thinking to making that happen. And let me tell you that if I say nothing else, my commitment together with the board, it's a fabulous board, is to do everything in our power to try to move that agenda forward. So let me just talk a bit about some of the issues. And I was asked to send learning objectives, and I did. And here they are. Basically, I'm going to try to touch on the global context of shaping healthcare agendas, talk a bit about the importance of influencing global and local health policies, and talk about the potential of impact of strength-based and evidence-based policies. And let me tell you that, fortunately or unfortunately, the more I travel, the more I develop a global perspective that helps me to reflect all the time, but it gets bigger and bigger and in some ways scarier of what's the magnitude of influence and where that influence happens. So let me have you walk with me a bit around that perspective. So we sit in this room and we think, okay, we as nursing not as influential, let us try to influence our CEOs, our provosts, our ministers of health. Well, I have news for you. You're wasting your time. Because their power and influence is there, but it's minimal. There is a much higher influence and the universe starts much earlier than those positions. And I think we have to understand those issues because they shape what happens. So who are those big influencers? Fortunately, or more so unfortunately, organizations like the World Bank, African Development Bank, the International Monetary Fund, regional governments, which is a whole new phenomena that we in Canada don't really appreciate it as much because it's not present in our North American sphere as much. We're all familiar with the European Union, but there are similar groupings, not as structured as the European Union, but similar groupings are in Asia. There are several of them in Africa, in Latin America, and so on and so forth. And the prime ministers and presidents come together and make policy decisions. So even when I go to a country, and I'm leaving Sunday to go to 12 countries, forget getting to the country. I better understand what's going on in the region and what's the conversations around those tables if I want to be heard and have a meaningful conversation. Because even those ministers and the governments in the country level have less impact and power and influence than what they used to be. And all you have to watch is the European Union, and that's an interesting and scary scene. Governments, the UN is a whole other agenda, and I'm just going to say a word or two about it and then move on because I don't want to turn it into a political science lecture. Until, I would say, even 10 years ago, when you wanted to talk about health policy and international policy, you mostly looked at the World Health Organization and a few other organizations. Where that's insufficient now. Because the World Health Organization and their six regional offices and so on, becoming more instruments of delivering the decisions that were done in the United Nations and other places. And interestingly, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, there was the only second global summit at the UN on a health issue, and it was on non-communicable diseases. It's what we call chronic diseases in this country, but it's really a broader perspective of non-communicable diseases. And if you look at it, and the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals, that have several of the 9 goals around maternal child mortality and so on, are all come out now from United Nations. So the power is shifting drastically over the last 10, 15 years, and it will continue to shift. And that shifting of a power has an incredible impact on how my work, your work looks tomorrow when you go into whether you are an educator or a practitioner and so on, because that's what percolates and drives the agenda. So the World Health Organization has been talking about the whole concept of universal coverage and access with no financial hardship. And here we will sit in Canada and say, wow, that's great. And 20 years ago, the World Bank and others were pushing for a free economy, privatization of healthcare, and so on and so forth. But while the universal coverage is really what's currently discussed, and it's more universal health access kind of thing, or universal health coverage, the intention is to say, yes, everybody has access to care, including more than the curative component, but it is in the free market concept. So when you look at what's going on, and it's shocking, it absolutely is painful and shocking, because a lot of the private-public partnership is being discussed. When you go to meetings like the meeting I was at this week in Brazil, is on health human resources and the concerns of the millions of positions that will be vacant and so on and so forth. You were hard-pressed to really find conversation around human resources. You were finding conversations around how to do private-public partnerships, how we talk about frontline. There is a new language is frontline workers. There are doctors and everybody else, right? And the whole notion of trying to demise the role and the profile of nursing is just unbelievable. And the more I see of it, it's kind of saying, oh my God, what did I do to myself? Do I want this pain and agony over the next few years? On the other hand, I think all of us, and we have seen perfect example of it all through the morning, that feel the drive and the passion to care for the people that need our support, you kind of say we need to do whatever we need to do at different levels. And I think that's really my challenge to you. And I think that the second point of the conversation is how we gain the appreciation of the importance of influencing global and local health policies. And the Conference Board of Canada, which is a research, not-for-profit organization, but comes from the economic bent and corporate Canada, have been doing a lot of work on healthcare, which is something that it's pretty interesting. But I think healthcare is an economic driver. And if you look at how many healthcare businesses are listed in the stock market, you will start to understand why people are so interested in healthcare, not so much from the benevolent perspective, but because it's a commodity. And the comment that the conference board has made, and I do like their work, is that Canada is in the bottom of the middle in health outcomes and in the top quartile in spending. So Canada is in the top five of the OECD, which is the developed countries in expenditure on health, but our outcomes are in the bottom quartile, which again gives you this gap, and you ask your question, why? And there are some very simple answers, and it's partially because we are a curative model. We are not a health model. We are an illness model. But here is where the deficit model plays in again. Everybody wants us to believe that the sky is falling down, that we are on a collision course, and if we are not careful, we all just gonna go to pieces, whatever the word is. And it's been reinforced by the media time and time again. Healthcare gonna eat every single penny, every single dollar, and we're not gonna have any money left for education, we're not gonna have any money left for roads, and we are the mean healthcare people, we are just keep consuming all the funds. Well, just like we talked about in the clinical context, that's a full of baloney. it's nowhere comes close to reality. And let's look at some facts. And I would say one of my lessons to you in the influencing of the world, get your evidence in hand. And if you have your evidence and you know what that evidence is, I think you are in a safe ground to start a conversation. So this is the reality check. In Canada in 2012, we spent $207 billion, like 31 cents of every dollar was spent on healthcare in 2000, and we're saying that 42 cents of every dollar will be spent on health by 2020. Well, what does it mean? What's the outcome? Do we do better? The reality is that we don't. If you look at the simple statistic, which is heartbreaking, of infant mortality, while we are not getting worse, we are dropping on the chart because everybody is getting better and we are not getting better. So we keep spending money, but the outcomes are poor. The other puzzling issue is that when it comes to number of beds per population, we are the lowest at this point. But where is all the money that we pulled out of the hospital system? Because when I talk to you as coming from the hospital sector, you're not telling me that you have all the resources to do what you need to do. You're saying, I can't get another nurse, I can't get another educator, I can't do the work. But we pulled it down to a level and the money is not flowing into home care, it's not flowing into your CLSCs, it's not flowing to rehab. What is really going on? So we really talk about the notion is that we're spending a lot of money, but what are we buying with that money? And I think that's really one of the questions. But the second more interesting point for me, and I know you can't read it, but 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the sixth column, which is really, I don't have a pointer, but if you count from the left to the right, is what's projected as Canada's expenditure going to be on healthcare. So when you look at it, and that's by 2040, we are not off the chart. Canada's healthcare expenditure is not going to be on a collision course. The sky is not falling down. It's not going to be the gremlin that eats education and eats everything else. But I think, again, the scare tactics and the deficit model of saying, oh, my God, is there really the exercise that is being taken on in order to get us comply with less and less and less. Interestingly enough, I think I lose track of the weeks. A week and a half ago, I was doing a keynote for the conference board, and André Picard, who you all know well, was moderating it. And in the beginning of the morning, he asked a few questions, and they all had to do with economic and other factors. This was a room of 250 informed people in healthcare. And we had those clickers that we had to choose an answer. Each one of the questions, the majority of the people chose a worse scenario than the reality is, which means that even with us, the scare tactics and the deficit model work so well. So we have a problem. And I think, Laurie, you talked about the butterfly. And the question is transformation possible? And is nursing part of the solution? And I absolutely think that we are. But the question is, at what level? And I think you have seen some glorious conversations of the influence in the practice level. And I would say right here and now that there is amazing nursing going on across this country. You lead the way. I would love to put on your shoulder and on your mind, and Ellen and others, you have to take it out across the country. This is the biggest secret in Canada, the incredible work that you do in Montreal, at McGill, and so on. So, Laurie, get on the bus with your friends and do a cross-country tour, you know? And let's paint on the bus. Laurie is coming. Strength-based nursing is coming. And let's go crisscross the country because nurses are hungry for this kind of information. So that's your job in many ways. But in spite of not taking it out, nurses do amazing work in spite of everything that's happening. So what? Is that gains you a seat at the boardroom? Does it gain you a seat at the government? We are the most trusted nurses in the profession in the world. So what? I will trade it any day for some real power. And we don't have that power. And the public is not standing up and saying, where is the nurse in that committee? Where is the nurse in that? And I think I was saying to Patricia and Lori last night that I was in a panel on collaborative practice in Brazil, and it was with the World Medical Association, ICN, and a few others. The question period, a Nigerian physician stands up and says, one of our biggest problems is turf war. I kind of thought, that's good. We have to deal with that, put it on the table. But then his second sentence was, imagine people even challenging the fact that our Minister of Health is a doctor. So I kind of thought, okay, how do I handle this one? And I said to him, you know what? I have a brilliant suggestion for you. I think you're right. I think that the Minister of Health should be a doctor. But the Minister of Finance needs to be a nurse. But I think the messages, and the room, of course, that didn't have lots of nurses in it, but the room burst out laughing, and even the laughter was in some way sad to me. Because what's so wrong with the idea of having nurses as ministers of finance? They can do so much worse than we can do it, in the sense that we are system people. I managed close to $500 million when I was the CEO. We can do it. But the thought of it sounds like, oh my God, this is the funniest thing I have heard. It's the best line. I think it tells part of our story and part of our challenge. Okay, so that's where we need to get into some of that level of influence. When I was at the Canadian Nursing Association as the president, we had a commission that Laura referred to because Gina Brown has done an amazing document for us. And Tom DiCuno, who was the head of the business association, one of those large business organizations, said to us, he was a commissioner, you need to dream big. You need to put out a challenging message. And the message was that Canada will be 150 years old in 2017. And on at least 5 of the global indicators, we need to be in the top 5, because we are not. You remember, we are in the bottom quartile. So the Canadian Nurses Association, after the report was out and so on, went to work in figuring out what should be 5 of the areas that we are pushing to reach certain levels in order for Canadians to be a healthier nation. And these are the 5 that they identified. And I'm not going to read each one of them. It is on the Canadian Nurses Association website. It's free of charge. You can download it even if you are not a member. Okay? And it basically looks at primary care, chronic diseases, electronic health information, hospital admissions for diabetes, and childhood obesity. It doesn't say nursing, nursing, nursing. It says in order for this country to be in a better place, we need to worry about those things. And that's what nurses do. Nurses basically say there are areas where we have solutions, but we need to move the agenda. And CNA will continue to push and speak out on those issues. Here is another kind of paradox for me, where nurses must play a role and strength-based nursing must play a role. Only 25% of your health status is dependent on the healthcare system. 75% of our health status is dependent on other factors, whether it's education, housing, employment, and so on and so forth. Somehow, as nurses, we gravitate to acute care and don't really make an effort to be employed in the community and the social sector. But that's health. And that's where we build up the capacity of individuals to have the strength to look after their own health and be able to move their agenda forward. So even if you are in love with acute care, at least consider serving in your community, whether it's in your church or whether it's in other settings, in some boards or in some places where the issues of literacy, women, others are getting dealt with, because that's what will build the strength of those individuals to have the health that they need to have. And nursing has to play a role. The other components where strength-based becomes so essential and team-based becomes so essential is those 5% of the very complex population, whether it's the multi-diagnostic people with diabetes, mental health, cancer, renal problem, whatever. You can pile it up, and there is only 5% of our population that consumes the bulk of the healthcare dollars. So I think the notion of you can't take the whole thing on, take on the complex areas and try to introduce the strength-based collaborative practice as part of the issue. And here is where I am more recently. We need two types of changes because we need to change the discourse. And those are both scientific terms, the disruptive leadership and wicked leadership. And the wicked leadership comes from the thinking of simple, complicated, complex, and now there is the discussion around wicked, which meaning that the problems are so horrendous that you cannot take it apart and you are pulling one place and other things move forward and so on. And there is a fair amount of writing around those things. But we need to understand that that's the nature of the problem we deal with, and unless we focus on some of those things, we're not going to change it. We really have to change the channel. We need a new day. And the question is whether strength-based leadership, strength-based practice, strength-based education will give us some of those things. And I think that strength-based approach has the making of that dealing with the new day in the weekend problem. Because remember what I started with, the simple answer of how I define and what got me so excited? Strength-based gives you the energy. And what's exhausting is to keep pushing the wall and the barrier and trying to open a crack in the world to move agendas forward. So you need that energy, and strength-based provides you that energy. So I very strongly believe that the strength-based approach able to help us. And the question is how. And I'm very excited because both Lori and others have gone through the 8 principles that came up at the paper that Lori, Bruce, and I have published on strength-based leadership. And I suggest that you look at it because Lori and Bruce have done a fabulous work of articulating the principles and transferring it to the leadership agenda. And let me tell you, we did not invent strength-based leadership. The strength-based leadership has been written extensively by the Gallups and others. So it is a concept that exists in mainstream leadership discussions. And I think it is just a pleasure to be able to practice and lead from the same framework, from the same way of thinking, so you don't have to change your hat and saying, oh, now I'm a manager, let me put a different hat. Now I am a clinical nurse specialist, let me put a different hat. But you can learn behavior in a certain perspective that you can transfer to the different domains of nursing. So I'm not going to work through it because you heard about it in the morning. And this is continuing on those 8 principles of self-determination, goodness to fit, promote learning and recognize the importance of readiness and timing and collaborative partnership. But here is, and I'm coming to the end, here is where I also taken some of the Judy Chamian's lessons of what needs to happen, because there are really two issues on my mind nowadays that need to be dealt with if we want to see nursing in 20 years alive and well. Remember this. We are going to go down, down, down and disappear if we are not going to pay attention to the two issues. And these are the two issues. The first issue is within the nursing family. And I see that all over the world. There is no harmony, collaboration, partnership between the various groups of nursing. So if you take unions, academics, executives, and so on, there is this tension or ignoring and so on. I look at the nursing associations in the various countries, you know, coming, and it looks different in different parts of the world. You go to Latin America, the educators think that they are the most important people on the face of the earth. They have no respect for necessarily the association or the unions and so on and so forth. You go other places. So you find pockets of partnership, but the order of the day is lack of partnership and lack of collaboration. So we must get that going. And interestingly enough, I made that comment in Brazil, and one of the people got up from Jamaica and said, I'm going home and that's my first order, getting the nursing groups to come to a meeting. And it's hard work. But if we truly believe that we need to have nursing as a contribution to global health, we have to figure that one out. You know, you look, Patricia, at your country, you look at the U.S. and so on, the fragmentations is scary. Again, incredible science, incredible brilliance, incredible production of knowledge. This is talking to me. But it's not helping me with the speech, so quiet. This is weird. Okay. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is that we absolutely need to figure out how to insert ourselves outside of nursing. And I understand why is it so much more comfortable to be in a room like this. The number of times I was wiping out tears in the morning is many. And it's just heartwarming and it's wonderful and thank you for it. Except, seriously, something is talking to me here. What is it? Okay. Translation? Something about oil. Maybe they're sending us money. But we have to break the wall and get influential outside of nursing. And we can't wait with it. It has to be in a hurry. So when there was this laughter about the Minister of Finance being a nurse, look around you and look at your cabinet and tell me how many nurses are in government, how many nurses are CEOs, how many nurses heading up CLSCs, how many nurses are heading up other things that can bring them to a table where discussion can happen. And when a nurse does become a CEO, do you embrace and celebrate it, or are you kind of saying, oh, they are a traitor? Physicians figured it out. So when I was in Brazil with these 2,000 people, and sorry for talking about Brazil, but that's my immediate past experience. Next week I can talk about other experiences. There were on the podium, there was a gender balance. So gender wasn't as much an issue there, although gender is an issue overall. But I would say that the bulk of the people who were sitting at the podium were physicians. And they weren't sitting there as physicians because they are physicians, but because they used medicine as a jumping board to get into other things. So the regional director in the Pan American Health Organization is a physician. Ministers are physicians. In the World Bank, you know, in the African Development Bank, there is this individual who oversees billions of dollars. She's both an economist, public health expert, a physician, and the list goes on and on and on. We need to try to embrace the 30-plus in this country and globally and put them through a boot camp and help them to become politicians, involved, vocal people, and so on and so forth. And if we don't do it, if we just talk about it, and I'm so tired of being talking heads, is that we are in trouble. My marching ward, we all have to use a ward when you become a president of ICN. My ward has been impact. And basically, I chose that ward after agonizing over dozens of wards, is because we know it. We have the science. We know we can do it, but somehow we are not able to influence the agenda. So here is a couple of things. Number one, you have to have a seat at the table. And I would suggest that each and every one of you go through the mental exercise at this second and ask yourself, if you are sitting at the table, that it's a non-nursing table. And if you are not, then hurry up and get there. But it's not enough to have a chair. What do you do with that seat that becomes absolutely essential? You have to be able to have an impact by linking to government and agencies. And it's difficult to do it as an individual, but there are professional organizations, there are other forms by which you can become active and link to and have an impact on organizations, both at the government and the municipality levels. So no one in Toronto now talking to the city of Toronto because they are busy with other things. But seriously, most of us in this country don't consider the municipalities as an important actors in healthcare. And they are the ones who are financing a lot of the playgrounds, a lot of the senior programs and so on and so forth. And there are opportunities for us to get involved and have a voice. And it's a terrific trajectory to get into other things. We need to engage politicians and become one. In the federal government at the moment, we have only three nurses who are politicians. One is a junior secretary of state in one of the departments. And you know what happened to him? Somebody wrote about him. He's a nurse and a lawyer, and he basically have not kept up his license, but he's educated to be a nurse. He worked for me at Sinai when I was at Sinai. Somebody put some promotional material out, not from his office, but that he's a nurse. Do you know what the College of Nurses in Ontario did? They sent him a letter to say that he will be getting a huge fine if he dares to use the title nurse again. Well, thank you very much. You know, I rest my case. Instead of saying, you know, it's an honest mistake and whatever, and we are so excited that you bring a nursing education to your portfolio, and we celebrate you being there. He's a junior secretary for Aboriginal issues. He's from the north of Northern Ontario. No, let's shoot them and let's kind of destroy any sympathy for nursing. And, of course, that's the story that he relates to me and others when he meet nurses. Not the glorious, you know, wonderful experience he had at Sinai, which he also talks about, but it's kind of, you know, how many of us like to get letters from our regulatory body? On the other hand, there is a nurse who is a member of NDP from Quebec. How many of you know her? She comes, no hands go up. She comes back once a month to do a weekend in an ICU somewhere in a rural setting. Okay? I would have loved to see her on the podium for your next meeting, because why not? Why not? She shows up to every meeting she's invited to in Ottawa as a nurse. So we don't have our compasses right. Somewhere we went fundamentally very wrong and lost the perspective of How are we going to get there? And again, these kinds of meetings are essential. They feed the soul and the mind, but they are insufficient on its own. Along the same line, the external, formal, and informal links. You know, if I go around the room and ask you to write down who you know in industry or in politics or in media, I'm sure we will come up with at least 3-4 dozen names. And when I ask people how many of them have used those links in the last 2-3 months to talk about nursing and health and so on, usually most of the hands go down. We are women, we are nurses, we are, don't exercise the strength we have, so that needs to change. We need to stay the course. So yes, we might have a meeting with somebody important, and then we say, okay, done. Well, to change some of the directions could take 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and we have to stay the course. It doesn't happen by sending a letter. You know, I hear people say, oh, I send a letter to the minister. Nice. You wasted the paper and the communication. Unless it's a strategically consistent manner, made you feel good, it didn't change anything in the face of the earth. We need to be strategic, realistic, and focused, and have a strong, strength-based relationship. I think when you look at the book, you understand relationship. And to me, if I have learned one thing about doing the ICN role and previous leadership positions, it's the importance of relationship. So when I walk into a minister's office or somebody who is senior somewhere, I don't start with my points. First of all, I do my homework before I go there on who they are and find a point and kind of get, Lori said I have two passions. I can't talk to them about football. I know nothing about it, but I know a lot about children and grandchildren and so on. So find somewhere to get into the point of getting to know the person somewhat and building a relationship. And you often will be surprised because sometimes you go into a meeting and you think, oh, let's just get it over with, and it turns out to be unbelievably successful and you go from there. Other times you go in, you know, I went into an assistant director general, which is the second in command in Geneva in WHO, and he was from Sweden. He worked in the region, so I thought, oh, this will be great meeting because we will be on the same wavelength. Well, it was the worst meeting I had the last month. And he says to me, I don't need nurses here. I don't need doctors here. I need public health officials. To which I said, I hear you, but if you look at the credentialing of your professional staff, 92% of them are doctors and 0.6% are nurses. Okay. And then he proceeded to give me lecture that for nursing to be powerful, we need to know how to do research. I thought I'm going to go out of, first of all, I was going to give him a bloody nose, but you can't do that. Because you never know, and you have to kind of, the goal is to be able to leave the door open to come back another time. But I thought I'm going to send him 20 boxes of research in order to just bury the office in it. Having said that, I left the office. I sent an email of saying it was great to meet, blah, blah, blah. He was the first to reply and saying, I would love to have more conversations with you. So go figure. You don't know. Was he testing me? Was he pushing the boundaries or whatever? I don't know. But you get those things and you need to persevere and you need to have a very thick skin and be strategic around those things. So I think what I basically take away from today is that we have to believe in ourselves. And I think what we have seen here today was just fabulous. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It just really charged my batteries for a while. But unless we figure out how to work inside and how we work outside, we cannot influence the healthcare agenda, and health will not improve, but will continue to slide. And nursing will slide with it. So the future is not something we enter. The future is something we create. Thank you.